This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. On today's roundtable, some Democrats are calling for Justice Department head Alberto Gonzalez to resign, and D.C.'s gun ban is overturned. Joining us today are Robert George, editorial writer at The New York Post, Marcelo Suarez Orozco, professor of globalization and education at New York University, and Glenn Lowry, professor of the social sciences and economics at Brown University. So thanks for being with us, everybody, and let's go straight to the FBI. Now, the Federal Bureau of Investigation improperly and at times illegally used the Patriot Act to secretly obtain personal information. At least that's what the U.S. Justice Department revealed last week. And now some Democrats want Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez to resign. Last week's report showed shoddy bookkeeping and records management problems, among other major missteps by the Bureau. FBI Director Robert Mueller says he shoulders the blame.
First, national security letters are absolutely essential for us to do our job in protecting the American public against terrorist attacks. But it is equally important that as we exercise these authorities, we do it consistent with the privacy protections and civil liberties that we in the FBI are sworn to uphold.
Now, he continued by saying that he takes full responsibility for upholding those standards. Marcelo, what does this mean to you?
Well, it means there are very serious privacy issues. There are issues pertinent to the boundaries here between this equilibrium, this balance that we keep coming back to between issues relating to national security, as they were framed by the director of the FBI, and civil rights questions, basic privacy issues, basic due process issues. It seems to me that this is a case where without the necessary checks and balances, a lot of information was gathered that perhaps shouldn't have been gathered.
Robert, is there any real sticking power to the idea that Alberto Gonzalez, Attorney General, is going to get some heat for this?
Well, I think there is, and it's because this is happening at the same time as the other controversy that's going on involving the Justice Department, and that's the firing of eight U.S. attorneys. Now, the U.S. attorneys, or federal prosecutors, as they're also known as, they serve at the will of the president. But these are all Republican U.S. attorneys, and they were all basically dismissed in a 2 or 3 week period at the end of last year, beginning of this year. And you've got a number of Republican senators who are asking why they were dismissed. So I think if it was just the issue of the Patriot Act and the FBI. And it have to be clear is exactly what happened here. When the Patriot Act was reauthorized and this issue of these national letters, of these security letters going out, the Justice Department or the FBI agreed to allow the number, how much they were going to be collecting, to be regularly reported to Congress. And it turns out that they had lowballed the figure by as much as 20%. And so Congress is basically saying that this is a violation of the law and a violation of their right to know. So I think the Democrats are obviously seriously pressing this issue, and that's one of the reasons why Chuck Schumer, the senator of New York, had called for Gonzalez's resignation. Meanwhile, you've got a number of angry Republican senators who want answers on the U.S. attorney's issue as well. So you could end up, Gonzalez could be feeling heat from both sides of the aisle.
Well, let me turn to you, Glenn. A lot of this is about privately gathered information, because as part of the what was at one point called total information awareness, and then they changed the name right after 9/11, you can merge private and public databases. So if you have a business transaction, it could end up in a government database of national security. So part of it is this kind of permeable membrane between what we consider private and what we consider public. Is that ever going to change back, or is the cat out of the bag on that one?
I think the cat may be out of the bag, as you put it, Farai. And I mean, that's one of my real concerns with this national security state that we're moving into. Now, I don't mean to just blast it, because, as has been said, we have real security needs. So it's a question of managing the boundary. But we've kind of opened a Pandora's box here. And therefore, accountability is absolutely essential. Oversight is absolutely essential. Playing by the rules, attention and care to the administration of these processes, transparency, all of that is absolutely essential. So the difficulty here in my mind, although we may well be going down a path that that we're not going to get off of in terms of a greater degree of intrusion into privacy as the necessary price we pay for security, the concern that I have is the lackadaisical administration of it. You know, before the Democrats took over Congress, Attorney General Gonzalez went up there arrogantly refusing to answer senators' questions when he was being asked about some of this stuff, saying, oh, I can tell you this much, but I can't tell you that much, and all of that. Those days are long gone. We've got a different Democratic Congress, and the administration is going to have to be much more transparent, much more responsive, and much more professional about its administration of these very dangerous but necessary programs.
Glenn, one more thing for you, since you do study economics, you're a professor of economics at Brown. It seems to me, from what I have read, and I'm a total privacy nut, not that I'm nuts about my own privacy, but about knowing what is legal and what is illegal and what there are trends in. It seems to me that things like your credit score, your purchasing history are going to become more and more a factor in whether you're considered a risky person. Even the military now evaluates people based on their debt ratio as to whether or not they should be sent abroad. So does this have special implications for African Americans, for other people of color who may not always have the same credit records as people who have of races that have more money and more means?
Yeah, and I think this is a good point. We call it disparate impact. You undertake a policy which is rational and sensible on its face, like, for example, evaluating people for some sensitive position based upon all the information that you can gather, including stuff about their credit, did they pay their rent, this and that. And then you apply this rational means to a population which is heterogeneous, in which people have different experiences. And so in the American population, if you use credit history as a way of screening people for jobs or whatever it might be, African Americans are going to be disadvantaged as a statistical matter. And even though no one may have set out with the intent of harming African Americans, the impact of the undertaking will be detrimental. And that's something that ought to be borne in mind and taken into account, although I can think of no hard and fast rule or guideline as to, what should be done. I say on a case-by-case basis, the possibility of adversely affecting a minority of the population should be taken into account.
Of course, Farai, of course, yes. The irony of that situation is, though, because just as you pointed out and we've discussed on the show before, they are indeed screening people in the military on their debt ratio. So if you look at the fact that African Americans proportionally may have more economic or financial difficulties, ironically, then that could actually keep them from going into harm's way because the military would not be sending them overseas because they could be considered a credit risk.
That is an interesting point. And with that point, I want to reintroduce everybody who's with us. This is NPR's News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. In case you're just tuning in, that was Robert George. He's editorial writer at the New York Post. Glenn Lowry, professor of social sciences and economics at Brown University, and Marcelo Suarez Orozco, professor of globalization and education, co-director of immigration studies at New York University. Let's move on, Marcelo, to the D.C. gun ban. A federal appeals court overturned Washington, D.C.'s handgun ban on Friday. Now, the district argued that under the Second Amendment, the right to bear arms belongs only to militias, not to individuals. This is an argument that's been made by many people at many times. The courts didn't agree. Residents in high crime areas spent years fighting to say that they have a right to protect themselves. This case could still be heard by the Supreme Court. Now, it's reported that the Supreme Court hasn't heard a gun case like this in almost 70 years. Do you think that this is going to come back to the table, Marcella?
I certainly think that this will go to the Supreme Court. And, of course, this is now in the context of new data on the numbers of homicides in certain pockets, in certain metropolitan districts in the United States. So we are going to have to revisit once again the boundaries of this debate and, again, rethink the balance between the right to bear arms and the intended and unintended or anticipated and unanticipated consequences of these propositions. But certainly this is a conversation that we'll come back to, and it will most likely, I believe the last time the Supreme Court spoke on the matter was in the 1930s. We're in for a major review of this case.
Well, you know, Robert, what strikes me is that it's residents in high crime areas who were like, no, we don't want this ban. We want to be able to protect ourselves. Do you find that completely sensical or nonsensical?
I think it's absolutely sensical, and I'm hoping that the Supreme Court does rule on this and does rule that, that there is indeed an individual right to bear arms. I mean, it's absolutely fascinating. I mean, and I lived in Washington D.C. for 10 years. It's absolutely fascinating that this has been on the books. This is supposed to be one of the strongest gun bans in the country. But year in and year out, Washington D.C. has always been in the highest localities for murder and violence committed by guns. So I mean, it was clearly in the context of the district, the gun ban was not working, and all it was doing was actually preventing law-abiding people from having guns themselves and protecting themselves. So it doesn't surprise me at all that you've got individuals who say, you know, I want to be able to protect my own family. I want to be able to protect myself. And instead, we've got this kind of law on the books, which is preventing me from doing that. And so I'm really looking forward to this case being hashed out in the courts.
Glenn, the preponderance of legal decision making is with people's individual ability to own guns. But let's move on to larger issues like safety. If D.C. can't prevent handguns in the city, what other measures should be taken to really ensure resident safety?
Well, D.C. should be able to prevent handguns in the city. I couldn't disagree with my colleague Robert Moore about this one. I mean, there's no surprise that an individual is going to say, let me have my gun, I feel safer. But it could be objectively true that we're all less safe if we're all armed than we would be if there were impediments to us acquiring arms. This is a situation where making guns harder to get could make everybody safer, even though an individual feels that they themselves would be safer if they were the one who had the gun. Let me just finish my thought.
I
understand that people are concerned because there is a safety problem out there. But what I'm saying is that the easy proliferation of guns actually makes us less safe. And I don't understand this philosophy of original interpretation that some people bring to the Constitution, which says that when the founders sat in basically a rural society that was not at all densely populated and the largest city may have had a couple hundred thousand people in it, and they said something, we have to be bound as if they were somehow clairvoyant to figure out exactly what they might have meant about that society 200 years ago and then apply it to our own. We live in cities where millions of people are crammed up on each other and where the public safety issues are really very palpable. Making guns harder to get, I think, would make us safer.
Robert, before you jump in, I just want to bring up that there have been several studies that show if you have a gun in your home, in many cases, you're more likely to be shot by your own gun. An intruder will take your gun than you are to save yourself. What do you?
Well, then, on the other hand, there are also these studies that show that in communities where they have introduced conceal and carry regulations, that the crime rate goes down, the shooting and the shooting incidents go down. So I mean, you can always find statistics. I mean, I believe that if somebody is going to have a gun, I mean, I think that they definitely have to go through training and how to use it and how to keep and carry it and so forth. I have no problems with that, but in terms of just the basics, in terms of a basic right to be to be able to protect yourself on your person in your home, I think that's something that should be a constitutional right and should be demonstrated as such.
I want to go to one last topic. Very little time for this, but Mainstream hip-hop has been indulging in bling culture, bling coming from diamonds on folks' fingers and all the gold chains, drinking lots of champagne. Now, at Texas Southern University, rapper Slim Thug shared a story about losing all that money. There's been a movement for hip-hop finance. He said, "I took my homeboys to the club, buying bottles, got the rims, you know what I mean, then I couldn't be paying the rent. Homeboys can't help you now." Now, one of the 26-year-old rapper's prized possessions was a $460,000 Rolls-Royce Phantom. Very quickly, everybody, and I'll start with you, Glenn. Are these hard luck stories of people who made it big going to make a difference to younger generations?
No, I don't think so. I mean, look, I you know, these guys are trying to do something, so I hate to slam them for trying to do something, okay? Because it's basically positive. Certainly there's a need for financial education, for encouraging people to go into business, manage their money right out there in Black and Latino America. But Slim Thug driving around in a Rolls Royce is going to tell us something about how to live. He's going to tell us how to live.
What if his name was Fat Thug? So that you, no, I'm sorry.
I hate to say this. Slim. This looked like it was something taken out of The Onion. I'm sorry.
But so many things in life feel like that, don't they?
Exactly. Slim meets Adam Smith here.
Well, yeah. I mean, yeah. Right. Exactly. You know, the invisible the invisible hand that has a Glock next to it. I'm sorry. I just can't. I can't take this seriously. I mean, in fact, it's not even just a matter of hip hoppers trying to, you know, be giving financial education. I mean, actually, if you wanted to get a course or a lecture from a Jay-Z or Russell Simmons, that might actually be worthwhile.
Well, Russell is.
But the history of entertainers. Forget about rap. The history of entertainers who, you know, become wealthy at a young age and then lose it within 5 or 6 years is so many. It's just so long. I just don't see. I don't think they're really the people you need to listen to.
We have to wrap this up, Marcelo. Briefly, though, if young people listen to entertainers, won't they listen to this?
That's correct. So, in as far as this is a positive message, I think let's say this, it can't hurt. I'm skeptical in terms of the long-term impact of this, but it's good that these folk that are highly visible, everyone identifies with, are addressing this issue.
All right, we got to end it
can't
right
touch
there.
This.
Can't touch this. Can't buy this. Can't rent this. Can't pawn this.
Can't believe it.
Marcelo Suarez Orozco, professor of globalization and education at NYU. He was at WLIU. Robert George, editorial writer at the New York Post, New York Bureau. Glenn Lowry, professor of social sciences and economics at Brown University, WRNI Radio in Providence, Rhode Island. Thank you all so much.